Ladies and gentlemen, please, if I may have your attention for a moment. Addiction and depression are ravaging our world. We've lost far too many people that are far too precious to us in this battle. Every member of the band that you see standing upon this stage has had its own experience, their own experience, with addiction and depression, either themselves or someone we know and love. And we miss so many of our dearly departed so very much. We miss Chester, we miss Chris, we miss Scott. We miss the Rev from Avenged Sevenfold. Paul Gray, Wayne Static, Keith Flint from The Prodigy. The list goes on and on and on. And to prove to you that this is not an epidemic that is exclusive to the world of entertainment, with your permission tonight, I'd like to try an experiment with you. By a show of hands, and no one here needs to be afraid, no one is being judged. By a show of hands, how many of you have struggled with the demons of addiction and depression yourself or know someone that has? Now take a look around. My friends, you are not alone. It's up to us to try to slow the disease. It's up to us to recognize tragedy before it occurs. And it's up to us to give everyone a reason to fight.
Nummer 721, 35C3, extra. Hallo und herzlichen Glückwunsch zum 721. Kompott, den ich nicht wirklich irgendwann aufnehme, sondern der aus ganz klassisch drei Chaos Communication Kongress Vorträgen, hier 35C3 Vorträgen besteht. Das Intro ist von irgendeinem Musikfestival, You Are Not Alone, und auch ganz klassisch aus der sechsten Folge der ersten Staffel einer gewissen Stranger Things Serie, She's a Friend and She's Crazy. Welchen Vortrag ihr jetzt hier allerdings auf und in die Ohren bekommen könnt, wenn ihr jetzt am Stück weiterhört, das ist dann Teil 3, der 35C3 Vortrag mit der Nummer 9599, Locked Up Science, wo Claudia Frick sich zum Thema der Wissenschaft, die da nicht öffentlich verfügbar ist, auf Englisch in 41 Minuten und 51 ins Benehmen setzt. Und was ich euch danach dann noch verabreiche, das erzähle ich euch danach. Viel Spaß mit dem Vortrag.
And now, please welcome our speaker, Claudia.
Thank you. So, hopefully there will be my slides up there. I see someone running fast. Here we go. Yes, so hello everybody, and welcome also from my side to one of the first talks of this year's Congress. My name is Claudia Frick, or if you know me from Twitter, my name is Fuzzy Leapfrog. And I'm about to refresh your memories on scholarly communication and scientific publishing. But since this is my first talk at a Chaos Communication Congress, I'd like to start with two facts about me so that you know who is talking to you. So fact number one, I am an atmospheric scientist, so I have a PhD in meteorology. Fact number two, I am now working as a librarian in the library of a research center. The most common reaction I usually get when I say this is, why? There are actually several reasons why I left science and joined the library world. And for the next 30 minutes, I'll talk about one of these reasons. And to be honest, it's the reason I'm most passionate about. Okay, so let's dive into the topic. And I'll start with a few simple questions that you can answer just for yourself. Do you think science helps us as a society to be well-educated and to make rational and fact-based decisions? Do you think science helps us to live healthier, longer, and to deal with diseases? Do you think science helps us to face global challenges like climate change? If you answered at least one of these questions with yes, then you must also think that restricting the access to scientific results is not beneficial for our society. Unfortunately, that's what we are currently doing. 72% of scientific publications are locked up behind paywalls, which means that only those with money have access to science, and those who don't have money are either left behind or they are forced to go illegal ways. And this is not how it should be. But how should it be instead? We should have open access to science. And open access means that everybody in the world should have access to science without any financial, technical, or legal barriers. At the end of my talk, I want you all to know what we can do to tear down the paywalls in scientific publishing and to achieve open access to science. But before we can talk about how we can change a system like scientific publishing, we have to understand how it works. So we'll start with a look on the question what the most common way of scientific publishing currently looks like. So for all the non-scientists in this room, or those who haven't published a scientific publication so far, let me take you on the roller coaster journey of scientific publishing. Imagine yourself to be an atmospheric scientist, a brilliant atmospheric scientist. And you spent the past 5 years of your life in your laboratory, and you made some time-consuming experiments. You ran some complex simulations, and after a lot of sweat and pain and a lot of tears, you finally found it. You found the solution to climate change. Yes. And it's absolutely great that you know how to reduce greenhouse gases back to a proper level and how to stop temperatures from increasing. But the whole scientific community, everybody in the world should know about it so that we can realize the solution and finally stop climate change. So you have to communicate your research in order for it to benefit society, and that you can get the Nobel Prize that you absolutely deserve. So you write down a summary of your solution into a manuscript of, let's say, 15 pages. But what's next? How do you distribute this manuscript in the community? Since I am at the Chaos Communication Congress and we are in the 21st century, I assume that most of you are currently thinking, yeah, just put it on the internet. Yeah, that's not what the most common way of scientific publishing looks like, at least not yet. What you will do instead is that you will either submit your manuscript to a scientific conference or to an academic journal. Which one you will do mainly depends on your discipline. So if you are, for example, a computer scientist, you will most likely submit your manuscript to a scientific conference. If you are an atmospheric scientist, you will most likely submit your manuscript to an academic journal. But both publishing processes are nearly the same, so I will only guide you through one of them. So since you are an atmospheric scientist, you now submit your manuscript about the solution to climate change to an academic journal. And at this stage, your manuscript is called a preprint. And your manuscript fits into the scope of the journal. Therefore, in the next step, a process of quality control starts. This is called peer review. Peers are other scientists, like, for example, these two guys. Yeah, I know that this is scary, but these two guys will have a look at your manuscript and check whether everything you did and wrote is valid and scientifically correct. Because maybe you only think you found the solution to climate change, but in reality, you made a really awful mistake already on page one. But that's not what happens to you, because you're brilliant and your solution is perfect. So these two guys only have some minor corrections and comments, and you integrate them into your manuscript and resubmit this new version to the journal. And now you are lucky, because the journal then says, yeah, okay, with these changes, we'll accept your manuscript for publication. And at this stage, your manuscript is called the postprint, because the content is now the final one that will be later printed in the journal or published online, since we are in the 21st century. And now in the last step, some typesetting happens, so your manuscript is brought into the layout of the journal, and then this fancy publisher's version is published on the journal website, from where everybody in the world can see that you found a solution to climate change. And this is what the most common way of scientific publishing currently looks like, simplified. But I forgot one very important detail, and this is the paywall. You published closed access. And at this point, I'm sorry, but we have to talk about money. Because there's a lot of money changing hands in this process. And the first occasion money changes its hands has actually nothing to do at all with the paywall. Because did you know that you, the author of the manuscript or your laboratory, might have to pay money to the publisher in order for your publication to get published? Yeah, maybe your manuscript was too long and you have to pay page charges. Or you included some colorful figures and you have to pay color charges. Yes, color charges in the 21st century. And the second occasion money changes its hands is at the paywall. Because there are a lot of scientists out there that need to know the solution to climate change. And some of them are lucky, like her, and they work for an institution that has money and that has a library. And this library will pay money to the publisher to grant these scientists access to your publication. Either by paying a subscription fee so that they have access to all publications in the journal, or by just purchasing your single publication. But there are a lot of scientists out there that aren't that lucky. And they won't have access to your publication. And what about all the non-scientists in this room that I'm sure also want to know the solution to climate change? They won't have access either, unless they are willing to pay. But who said that we, all together, didn't already pay for this publication? Because who funds you, the brilliant atmospheric scientist and your laboratory? Who funds the two guys doing the peer review? And who funds the libraries that grant other scientists access? It's us. We all do. It's taxpayers' money. So don't you think we kind of already paid for this publication? Okay, you might now think, but hey, there will obviously be money coming back. because authors and people doing peer review will get paid for their work by the publisher? No, that doesn't happen in science. Scientists are doing all of this work cost-free for the publisher. Okay, but then you might think, but hey, then maybe this is just the business model of academic publishers? I mean, they definitely have their costs that they need to cover. So maybe they are just doing this, covering their costs, and they are not making so much more money out of it? Huh. We are currently having three major academic publishers. They are called Elsevier, Springer, and Wiley. And let's have a look at the profit margins of at least Elsevier and Springer. They are 35 and 37% pure profit. These margins are even higher than the ones of Google and Apple. We are all together paying in every year 7.6 billion euros for access of publications. 7.6 billion euros per year. And this has some very weird practical consequences. Because publishers are requesting so much public money to get access to mainly publicly funded publications that even those that really do have money, like the Harvard University, can't no longer afford them. And when I learned this, all of this, for the first time, I only had two options left. Option number one, join the open access movement and tear down these paywalls. Option number two, become myself an academic publisher. My bank account this morning said I chose option one. So let's talk about how we can tear down the paywalls. There are generally a lot of approaches we can take. Some of them are smaller but persistent, and others are more massive steps. But who can do anything about the paywall? Who are the involved players in scientific publishing? Well, we have the scientists that do most of the work. They produce the content, they do the quality control of the content, and they are even the ones that later in the process mainly consume the content. Then we have the funders that provide the money. We have the libraries that grant access, and we have the publishers that publish the academic journals. Since I assume that we are not having so many funders and publishers in here, and I don't think that the number of librarians is higher than 10, I'd like to focus on what scientists can do to tear down the paywall. But I will also have a look on what we can achieve if the first three players work together. But let's start small with you, the brilliant atmospheric scientist. So you just published your solution to climate change like this. And you just realized, damn, I published behind a paywall. And a lot of scientists won't have access to my publication. And usually that's not what scientists want. Because most scientists I know want their publications to be read, to be spread, to be cited, and to be discussed as widely as possible. And a paywall prevents this. So you might now wonder whether there's anything you can do about the paywall when you publish like this. Yes, you can do something about it. The first option you have is brought to you by the publisher. The publisher offers you the possibility to remove the paywall just in front of your single publication, while all other publications in the journal remain behind the paywall. This is called hybrid open access. And what does the publisher want to remove the paywall in front of your publication? Yeah, it's even more money. Yeah, I do not recommend this. Isn't there anything you can do about this publication without paying even more money to the publisher? I mean, it's your publication. It's your work that you've done. Can't you just take it from the journal website and put it on the internet? This is called a secondary publication, and there are places for this. They are called archive, institutional repositories, or even the commercial website ResearchGate. Can't you just upload your manuscript there and make it available via so-called green open access? The answer to this question is, it depends. Because what happened when you decided to publish behind a paywall is that you signed a so-called copyright transfer agreement. And it is what it literally says. You signed away the copyright of your work to the publisher. Yeah. So if you want to republish your manuscript somewhere else, you have to check whether this is okay for the copyright owner, that is, the publisher. But hey, some good news here. Most publishers will allow at least some form of republication. But this is where it gets really, really tricky. Because publishers are having some very specific and very restrictive conditions on this. So you cannot just publish any version of your manuscript. Maybe you can only publish the preprint, that is the version of your manuscript without all the changes that came in during peer review. So it's not the content that you finally published. And they have some very specific conditions on where you can publish. Maybe you can only do it on your personal website, but not on the one of your university. And then they have some very specific ideas on when you can republish. Because you cannot just do it right away most of the times, you have to wait an embargo period of 6 months, 12 months, or even 4 years. And 4 years is kind of a long time to wait for a solution to climate change. And these conditions, they do not only vary by publisher, they vary by journal. So you really have to check for each single of your publication what you are allowed to do and what not. And I totally get it. That's not easy. That's confusing. It's time-consuming. And believe me, it's absolutely no fun at all. But if you are ever struggling with this as a scientist, I have a very simple and convenient advice for you, and it is to just ask your librarian. Because that's our business. And I'm absolutely sure that even in your library, there's at least one librarian that has specialized on copyright and can do this for you. But wouldn't it be so much easier if you could just do whatever the hell you want to do with your publication? If you could just keep the copyright right away? Yes, it would be. And it's possible. So maybe the next time you publish a solution to a global challenge, publish it gold open access. This means that you will publish in a so-called open access journal. These journals do not have any paywall at all, and all publications in there are published under a Creative Commons license, so you will keep the copyright of your work. How do these journals work? Well, let's get back to closed access. What open access journals obviously do is that they remove the paywall, which means that libraries don't have to pay money to the publisher to grant their scientists access. And what also happens is that you are no longer asked to pay color charges, but you have to pay an article processing charge or your laboratory. But since libraries are saving a lot of money by not paying for access to these journals, most German libraries, for example, will cover these costs for you. But it can be even better. Because there are a lot of open access journals out there that do not even charge an article processing charge. This is called Platinum Open Access. And these journals do not ask for money from anyone, neither for reading nor for publishing. But how do these journals even survive? Because they are not making any profit? Well, we know that scientists are already doing most of the work in this process. And some of them decided to just do the rest of the work too. Yes, there are scientists out there running their own academic journals. Several of them joined forces with their libraries to have a powerful and experienced infrastructure in the background, and together, scientists and librarians are providing this non-for-profit service for science in the hands of scientists without any commercial interests. So this is already an example of what we can achieve if we are no longer only focusing on you, the single scientist, and your single publication, but if we look at what we can achieve if we work together and join our forces. And there are a lot of more examples out there for this. I listed a few over here. And for the rest of the talk, I'd like to focus on one of them, mainly because it's a German project and it got some recent attention. And this is Project Deal. Project Deal is commissioned by the Alliance of Science Organizations in Germany and is driven by scientists and librarians together. And what they want to achieve is a major step forward to open access with our three already known major academic publishers. And Project Deal wants to achieve this by implementing so-called nationwide consortium agreements. But what is a nationwide consortium agreement? And what can it do about open access? These agreements consist of two components. They are so-called publish and read deals. And the first component is the read component, and it means that all participating institutions, universities, will have access to all journal publications of the publisher when there is a deal. And the publish component means that all publications with a corresponding author from one of these participating institutions and universities will be published open access with this publisher. And both of these components are covered with one single and one reasonable fee. So, for example, if your university would be part of such a deal with Elsevier, you would have access to all Elsevier publications, and all your publications would be published open access with Elsevier. This would mean that there would be up to 60,500 publications published every year open access under such a deal. And this is what Project Deal wants to achieve. So these are the goals. But how is Project Deal progressing? There are currently ongoing negotiations with Wiley and Springer. So there are two parties, the publisher and Project Deal, sitting together at one table and having a major common understanding about the future of scientific publishing and about what the basic conditions of such a deal should be. And they are now discussing the details. The picture becomes quite different if we look at Elsevier, because there seem to be right away a major disagreement about the basic conditions of such a deal should have and on what a reasonable fee is. So after a long time, years of negotiating and no real progress, what happened is that Project Deal, so scientists and librarians, currently suspended the negotiations with Elsevier. And this is something new, and it's definitely something big. And I can tell you that the world is watching Project Deal in Germany. And this is where the power of joining forces really shows up. Because scientists and librarians are really emphasizing the need for such a deal to Elsevier. For example, scientists stop to offer their cost-free work to Elsevier. So they are no longer publishing with Elsevier or doing the peer review. If you are one of them, or will be one of them after this talk, please let your library know, because we collect this information and make sure that Elsevier knows. And libraries, well, they just cancel their subscriptions to Elsevier journals. Yes, there are currently 200 German institutions without subscription access to Elsevier publications. And there will be even more next year. The Max Planck Society canceled the contract to the end of this year. So these are a lot of scientists without access to Elsevier publications. And it's a lot of saved money. And what happened after we got cut off from Elsevier Publications 6 months ago? Well, the world of science didn't break down, neither did the world of libraries. What happens is that scientists use alternative ways to get access, and libraries support these alternative ways. I listed a few of the legal alternatives up here. But speaking of legal, some of you might now wonder or wonder through the entire talk, why should we even care about subscriptions? Why should we pay for access to publishers or use alternative ways that are legal? Because Sci-Hub? Sci-Hub is basically the Pirate Bay of science, so you can get nearly any scientific publication there. And I'd like to forward the question on why we should pay for access if we have Sci-Hub directly to the publishers. But I think that they already know the answer, because they do what industries do that face piracy. They took legal action and filed a lawsuit. They requested internet service providers to block Sci-Hub. But you know, don't mess with the internet. So, dear publishers, let me put it this way. As long as you publishers hold on to paywalls, there will be piracy, no matter what. And even worse, as long as you hold on to paywalls, there will be people, scientists and librarians, building alternative ways of scientific publishing without you. And the only way to stop this is to tear down the paywalls. And to you, the brilliant atmospheric scientist, and all the other brilliant scientists in this room, please provide open access to your publications and support open access in any way that you like or that you can. And if you have any questions or concerns or any ideas, I can only encourage you to talk to your librarian. Because if we work together, if we join our forces, I think that we can finally unlock science. Thank you.
Thanks for this amazing talk. Okay, everybody, you know the rules. If you have questions, please line up at the microphones. There's five of them, two there, and one there in the corner. And if you are on the stream, just somehow ask the question. I'm not really aware how it works. And then we have someone here to read the questions out to be our human interface device. So please, microphone number one.
Thank you for your talk. The scientist and the librarian here, which we did not address yet, and I want to ask you this question. The publishers, they have the brands we as scientists need. What I mean with that is, a part of the quality assurance scientists did, we ranked the journals, we gave them impact factors and other things. So the journal itself has a quality number. So for a young scientist, at least for me, it was very difficult to publish in a way that gives me the academic reputation I need without having access to the highly ranked journals of the closed source publishers. So yep. Is there a way we can get out of this deadlock where we need to publish in these journals that we do not want to publish in?
Yeah, we can talk about the impact factor. I love it. Yeah. Really love. It's absolutely difficult because this is a self-enforcing system dealing with reputation. And if you think about it, if all scientists would immediately stop to publish with Elsevier or the reputable journal and would move to another one that has no impact factor at all, after 5 or 6 years, this journal would have the high impact factor. But it's true that it's not that easy to just do it because you want to come forward with your career, and it's a problem. But there's no real solution so far for this. So Project Deal is kind of addressing this idea by remaining with the major publishers. So this would be the easiest way out for this problem. Yeah.
Do we have an internet question? Yes?
Yes.
Can someone turn on the mic for the signal angel, please?
What influence do the university have on the publishing process of their scientists? Can a university force their scientists to publish in a certain way or with a specific publisher?
No, it's not that easy. There are policies that state that you have to publish open access, but most of them do not define how you can do it. So you can do green or gold or hybrid, whatever you want, but they just state that you have to publish open access.
Microphone number two, please.
Hello. the internet has given everybody access to their own streaming platform. How do we avoid the public sharing of science to be tainted with all the bad science out there?
With what?
Bad science. There's a lot of... If you look at the newspapers and stuff,
yeah,
there's a lot of fake news.
You should absolutely not remove the peer review process at the moment out of this scientific publishing process. So there should be some quality control. But there are some ideas to change the way peer review is done. But if you remove it, yeah, then you have a problem at the moment.
Mic number three, please.
Hello. Do you have any statistics about how many open access publications there are compared to, I would say, classical Elsevier and stuff? Or if the movement is advancing, if it's getting traction?
Yeah, I stated the source of the 72% closed access publications, and there's a detailed analysis on how many articles are closed, hybrid, gold, green. I published the slides already. I will tweet them later. Okay.
Thank you.
And the signal angel, please.
What do you think about the Plan S initiative?
Plan S, for those who don't know, it's a coalition of research funders in Europe, not the Deutsche Forschungsgemeinschaft, but all others, and they want to have open access immediately. So they say when you work for us, if you're funded by us, you have to publish open access, and I think that this is a good approach.
Can we get mic two, please?
Hi. Could the journals printed by various universities like solve that issue which was raised here about having a well-known brand behind the publications? For example, if you have a university which is very famous, it can release their own journal and solve that brand issue.
If they release their own journal, I hope it's open access. But I think that it's in general an illusion to think that the name of the journal or the publisher has anything to do with the quality of a single paper in there. So this linked idea, I think it's kind of broken.
Mic number one, please.
Against Sci-Hub but leave archive.org alone for all these years. I essentially get the same thing from both. I know there are differences in the details, but...
Yeah, it's restricted to a specific community, and so it's not for all publications, and it's still about preprints and postprints, so not the final publisher version, but I think that they didn't because it's a powerful tool and it's a powerful community. Yeah.
Could we get the internet again, please?
Somebody on the internet has heard that scientists sued the editors asking for a share of the profit of their work. Did you get any feedback how this ended?
No, but that sounds interesting. No, sorry.
Number four, please.
Historically, journals provide three aspects for scientists. They provided logistics, like delivery of papers to whoever wanted to read them. They provided editors, which is like not peer review, but the redditors which are hired by journals. And they provide reputational engines. Obviously, putting PDF online is a solid problem, so logistics is not longer a problem for the fully decentralized alternative to the journals. Can we decentralize other two?
I actually didn't hear the question properly. I'm sorry.
Try again.
So, journals are providing free services. They provide delivery.
Free services?
Free, like number free. They provide delivery to whoever wants to read them. They provide a reputation engine, and they provide editors. Like, not peer reviewers, but real editors on salary. We can decentralize with internet, we can decentralize delivery. Can we decentralize editors? Can we decentralize reputations?
Is there going to be a question at any point?
Yeah, I got the question, I think. But did you know that editors are also scientists? So they are already scientists doing this work. So I really question the high value that publishers provide to science. I think there is some value, but it's not that high as we all thought.
Number two, please.
Does Project Deal include any incentives for the scientists to publish gold open access instead of hybrid?
So if you publish with a publisher that has a deal with your university, that it will be open access no matter what?
Yeah. Does it include incentives to publish in journals that are only open access instead of mixed open and closed access publications?
No, not so far. I know.
Okay, just a quick interjection. Please remember, when you leave, please leave after the talk, but when you leave, please use the front exit and not the entrance in the back. Thank you. Could we get another internet question? Okay, the internet is out of questions. That's excellent.
Yeah.
Number one, please.
Yeah, advantage to closed access journals, maybe it would be a good idea to rethink the format of the publishing. I don't want to advertise it, but I think it's a good example. There's distill.pub, which is a journal for artificial intelligence at the moment mostly, and they publish it in HTML because it's the current year and you have interactive stuff,
yeah.
so you can play around with it, and it's really nice.
I think it would be better if we wouldn't have only PDFs published from the journal articles. There should be other formats, definitely. Machine readable.
Mic number two, please, for the last question.
I'm also, like you said, your opinion is that it's at least questionable what publishers provide to science and to society, if that's worth something or worth what we think. I also think this way, and if I have a manuscript now that I don't want to publish in this way, in this system, do you have any recommendation, maybe any program, project or something where I could maybe say, here's my manuscript, and then especially have a solution for the peer review process that is now facilitated by the publisher, but the publisher doesn't do anything, he's just facilitating it. So how could I solve this and go around the publisher in this way?
So I'm not sure whether I get the question, because if you have open access journals, there's also peer review. Yes, there are publishers, but if you have Platinum open access, this peer review process is organized with the library or scientists that are running the journal. So this is already organized, the peer review process, for other sorts of journals that do not have a paywall.
Do these Platinum open access journals cover all fields of science? Could I come with my...
There are a lot of there. There are a lot out of there. I can tell you how you can find them. There is a directory of open access journals where you can filter through any subjects and filter for how much do they cost. Yeah.
And now please thank our speaker again.
Thank you.
So, wir sind beim Danach angekommen und das ist wieder ganz klassisch, PS22 von, das ist dann aber 2018, Netherly mit dem Titel Hello, 3 Minuten 41, gefolgt von auch ganz klassisch Mike Massimino, A View of the Earth in 1726. Und dann sage ich wieder danke fürs Anhören, fürs Runterladen, nicht so sehr fürs Streamen, für den Fall, dass euch überkommt und ihr irgendeine Form von Reaktion auf irgendwas in meine Richtung werfen wollen würdet, was hier passiert ist. Seid ihr herzlich dazu eingeladen, das zu tun, indem ihr einen Tweet at Compot, eine Mail an compiblog@gmail.com oder einen Kommentar im compiblog.de und dem Eintrag zu Compot 721 Teil 3 einstelltet. Und dann wünsche ich euch viel Spaß mit der Musik und dem Outro und bis zum nächsten Mal, wenn ihr nichts dazwischen kommt.
In 1984, I was a senior in college, and I went to see the movie The Right Stuff. Yeah. And a couple things really struck me in that movie. The first was the views out the window of John Glenn's spaceship, the view of the Earth, how beautiful it was on the big screen. I wanted to see that view. And secondly, the camaraderie between the original seven astronauts depicted in that movie, how they were good friends, how they stuck up for each other, how they would never let each other down. I wanted to be part of an organization like that. And it rekindled a boyhood dream that I had that had kind of gone dormant over the years. And that dream was to grow up to be an astronaut. And I just could not ignore this dream. I had to pursue it. So I decided I wanted to go to graduate school, and I was lucky enough to get accepted to MIT. And I went up to MIT with the intention of following this dream of spaceflight. And while I was at MIT, I started applying to NASA to become an astronaut. And I filled out my application, and I received a letter that said they weren't quite interested. So I waited a couple of years, and I was graduating from MIT, and I sent in another application a second time a few years later, and they sent me back pretty much the same letter. So I applied a third time, and this time I got an interview, so they got to know who I was, and then they told me no. So I applied a fourth time. And on April 22nd, 1996, I knew the call was coming, good or bad. And I pick up the phone, and it's Dave Lietzema, the head of flight crew operations at the Johnson Space Center in Houston. And I say hello, and he says, "Hey, Mike, this is Dave Lietzema. How you doing this morning?" And I said, "I really don't know, Dave. You're going to have to tell me." And he said, "Well, I think you're going to be pretty good after this phone call, because we want to make you an astronaut." 13 years after that, it's May 17, 2009, and I'm on Space Shuttle Atlantis, about to go out and do a spacewalk on the Hubble Space Telescope. And our task that day was to repair an instrument that had failed. And this instrument was used by scientists to detect the atmospheres of far-off planets. Planets in other solar systems could be analyzed using this spectrograph to see if we might find a planet that was Earth-like or a planet that could support life. And just when they got good at doing this, the power supply on this instrument failed. It blew. It wasn't working. So the instrument could no longer be used. And there was no way really to replace this unit or to repair the instrument. Because when they launched this thing and they got it ready for spaceflight, they really buttoned it up. They didn't want anybody to screw with this thing, whether you were on the ground or whether you were in space. It was buttoned up with a access panel that blocked the power supply that had failed. And this access panel had 117 small screws with washers. And just to play it safe, they put glue on the screw threads so they would never come apart. You know, it could withstand the space launch, and there's no way we could get in to fix this thing. But we really wanted this capability back. So we started working, and for 5 years, we designed the spacewalk, and we designed over 100 new space tools to be used. Great taxpayer expense. Millions of dollars, thousands of people worked on this. And my buddy, Mike Good, who we call Bueno, he and I were going to go out to do the spacewalk. I was going to be the guy actually doing the repair. And inside was my friend Drew Feustel, one of my best friends. He was inside. He's going to read me the checklist. And we had practiced for years and years for this. And they built us our own practice instrument and gave us our own set of tools so we could practice in our office, in our free time, during lunch, after work, on the weekends. We became like one mind. He would say it, I would do it. We had our own language. And now's the day to go out and do this task. The thing I was most worried about leaving the airlock that day was my path to get to the telescope, because it was along the side of the space shuttle. And if you kind of look over the edge of the shuttle, it's kind of like looking over a cliff at that point with 350 miles to go down to the planet. And when we're spacewalking, we like to grab onto things in our space gloves and be nice and steady. But I got to this one area along the side of the shuttle, and there were no good handrails to grab. I had to grab like a wire or a hose or a knob or a screw. And I'm kind of a big goon. And when there's no gravity, you know, you can get a lot of momentum built up, and I could go spinning off into space. And I knew I had a safety tether that would probably hold, but I also had a heart that I wasn't so sure about. So I knew they would get me back. I just wasn't sure what they would get back on the end of the tether when they reeled me in. So I was really concerned about this. And I took my time, and I got through the treacherous path and out to the telescope. And the first thing I had to do was to pull off or remove a handrail from the telescope that was blocking the access panel. And there were two screws on the top, and they came off easily. And there was one screw on the bottom right, and that came out easily. And the fourth screw is not moving. And my tool is moving, but the screw is not. And I look close, and I realize it's stripped. And I realize that that handrail's not coming off, which means I can't get to the access panel with these 117 screws that I've been worrying about for 5 years, which means I can't get to the power supply that failed, which means we're not going to be able to fix this instrument today, which means all these smart scientists can't find life on other planets, and I'm to blame for this. And I could see what they would be saying in the science books of the future. This was going to be my legacy. I realized this. That my children and my grandchildren would read in their classrooms, we would know if there was life on other planets. But Gabby and Daniel's dad, my children would suffer from this. Gabby and Daniel's dad broke the Hubble Space Telescope and will never know. And through this nightmare that had just begun, I look at my buddy, Bueno, next to me in his spacesuit, and he's looking at me like, don't look at me. You know, Bueno was a rookie, and his job was to basically hand me tools. You know, this was my job to fix this thing. And then I turn and look into the cabin where my five astronaut friends, my crewmates are in there, and I realize nobody in there has got a spacesuit on. They can't come out here and help me. And then I actually looked at the Earth. I looked at our planet, and I thought, there are billions of people down there. But there's no way I'm going to get a house call on this one. You know, they cannot, no one can help me. And I felt this deep loneliness. And it wasn't just a Saturday afternoon with a book alone. I felt detached from the earth. I felt that I was by myself, and everything that I knew and loved and that made me feel comfortable was far away. And then it started getting dark and cold because we travel 17,500 miles an hour. 90 minutes is one lap around the Earth. So it's 45 minutes of sunlight and 45 minutes of darkness. And when you enter the darkness, it is not just darkness. It's the darkest black I have ever experienced. It's like the absence of light. And it gets cold. And I could feel that coldness, and I could sense the darkness coming. That's what we were going to enter. And it just added to my loneliness. And for the next hour or so, we tried all kinds of things. I was going up and down the space shuttle, trying to figure out where I needed to go to get the next tool they wanted me to get to try to fix this problem. And nothing was working. And then they called up after about an hour and 10 or 15 minutes of this. They said they wanted me to go to the front of the shuttle to a toolbox and get vice grips and tape. And I thought to myself, we are running out of ideas. I didn't even know we had tape on board. I'm going to be the first astronaut to use tape in space during a spacewalk. But I followed directions. So I get to the front of the space shuttle and I open up the toolbox and there's the tape. And at that point, I was very close to the front of the orbiter, right by the cabin window. And I knew that my best pal was in there trying to help me out. And I could not stand to even think of looking at him because I felt so bad about the way this day was going, the way it turned out. Not like what we had thought about, but all the work he and I had put in. And I couldn't even stand to even think of looking up at him. But I realized that he's actually, through the corner of my eye, through my helmet, you know, just aside there, I can kind of see that he's trying to get my attention. And I look up at him like this, and he's, you know, a little bit above me in the window, and he's just cracking up smiling and giving me the okay sign. And I'm like, is there another spacewalk going on out here? And I really can't talk to him because if I say anything, the ground will hear. You know, Houston will hear, the control center will hear. So I'm kind of like playing charades with him. I'm like, what are you, nuts? And I expect him, I didn't want to look because I thought what he was going to do instead of giving me the okay sign, I thought he was going to give me the finger. Because, you know, I'm thinking he's going to go down in a history book with me. So, but he's saying, no, we're okay. You just hang in there a little bit longer. We're going to make it through this. We're in this together. You're doing great. Just hang in there. And if there was ever a time in my life that I needed a friend, it was at that moment. And there was my buddy, just like I saw in that movie, the camaraderie of those guys sticking together. And I didn't believe him at all. I figured we were really, that we were out of luck. But I said, at least if I'm going down with my best pal. And as I turned to make my way back over the treacherous path one more time, Houston called up and told us what they had in mind. They wanted me to use that tape to take the bottom of the handrail and then see if I could yank it off the telescope. And he said it was going to take about 60 pounds of force for me to do that. And Drew answers the call and he goes, 60 pounds of force. And they call me Mass. It's short for my last name. He goes, Mass, I think you got that in you. What do you think? And I'm like, you bet, Drew. Let's go get this thing. And I get back to the telescope and I put my hand on that handrail. And the ground calls again, and they go, well, Drew, you know, you guys are okay to do this, but right now we don't have any downlink from Mike's helmet camera. I got these cameras mounted on my helmet so they can see everything I'm doing. It's kind of like your mom looking over your shoulder when you're doing your homework, you know. And they go, we don't have any downlink for another 3 minutes, but we know you're, you know, we're running late on time here, so if you have to. And I'm saying, let's do it now while they can't watch. Because The reason I'm taping this thing is there, if any debris gets loose, they're going to, you know, get all worried and it's going to be another hour and we'll never fix this thing. We've been through enough already. So I'm like, let's do it now while mom and dad aren't home. Let's have the party. So I'm like, Drew, I think we should do it now. And Drew's like, go. And bam, that thing comes right off. And I pull out my power tool and now I've got that access panel with those 117 little bitty screws with their washers and glue and I'm ready to get each one of them. And I pull the trigger on my power tool and nothing happens. And I look and I see that the battery is dead. And I turn my head to look at Bueno, who's in his spacesuit again, looking at me like, what else can happen today? And I said, Drew, the battery's dead in this thing. I'm going to go back to the airlock and I'm going to swap out the battery and I'm going to recharge my oxygen tank because by all this moving around, I was getting low on oxygen. I needed to get a refill. And he said, go. And I'm going back over that shuttle and I noticed two things. One was, That treacherous path that I was so scaredy cat sissy pants about going over, it wasn't scary anymore. That in the course of those couple hours of fighting this problem, I had gone up and down that thing about 20 times. And my fear had gone away because it was no time to be a scaredy cat. It was time to get the job done. And what we were doing was more important than me being worried. And it was actually kind of fun going across that little jungle gym that I had back and forth over the shuttle. And the other thing I noticed is that I can feel the warmth of the sun. We were about to come into a day pass, and the light in space, when you're in the sunlight, is the brightest, whitest, purest light I have ever experienced. And it brings with it warmth, and I could feel that coming, and I actually started feeling optimistic. And sure enough, the rest of the spacewalk went well. We got all those screws out, new power supply, buttoned it up. They tried it. They turned it on from the ground. It all was working. The power supply was working. The instrument had come back to life. And at the end of that spacewalk, after about 8 hours, I'm inside the airlock getting things ready for Bueno and I to come back inside. And my commander says, hey, Mass, you know, you've got about 15 minutes before Bueno's going to be ready to come in. Why don't you go outside of the airlock and enjoy the view? So I go outside, and I take my tether, and I clip it on a handrail, and I let go, and I just look. And the Earth, from our altitude at Hubble, we're 350 miles up. We can see the curvature. We can see the roundness of our home planet. And it's the most magnificent thing I've ever seen. It's like looking into heaven. It's like paradise. And I thought to myself, this is the view that I imagined in that movie theater all those years ago. And as I looked at the Earth, I also noticed that I could turn my head and I could see the moon. And I could see the stars, and I could see the Milky Way galaxy, and I could see our universe. And I could turn back, and I could see our beautiful planet. And at that moment, it changed my relationship with the Earth. Because for me, the Earth was always a kind of a safe haven, you know, where I could go to work or be in my home or take my kids to school. But I realized it really wasn't that. It really is its own spaceship. And I had always been a space traveler. And all of us here today, even tonight, we're on this spaceship Earth amongst all the chaos of the universe, whipping around the sun and around the Milky Way galaxy. A few days later, we get back. Our families come to meet us at the airfield. And I'm driving home to my house with my wife and my kids in the back seat. And she starts telling me of what she was going through during that Sunday that I was spacewalking, and how she could tell, listening, watching the NASA television channel, how sad I was, that she detected a sadness in my voice that she had never heard from me before. And it worried her until she heard me say, "For the love of Pete." And once she heard that, she knew everything was going to be okay. It's a line from Little Rascals. Anyway, so I thought, you know, I wish I would have known that when I was up there, because this loneliness that I felt, really, Carol was thinking about me the whole time. And we turned the corner to come down our block, and I could see my neighbors are outside, and they've decorated my house, and there's American flags everywhere. And my neighbor across the street is holding a pepperoni pizza and a six-pack of beer. Two things that, unfortunately, we still cannot get in space. And I get out of the car, and they're all hugging me. I'm still in my blue flight suit, and they're hugging me and saying how happy they are to have me back and how great everything turned out. And I realized, no, my friends, man, they were thinking about me the whole time. They were with me, too. The next day, we have our return ceremony. We make these speeches. These engineers who had worked all these years with us, our trainers, the people that worked in the control center, they start telling me how they were running around crazy while I was up there in my little nightmare all alone, how they got the solution from the Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland, and how that team that was working on that Sunday figured out what to do, and they checked it out, and they radioed it up to us. And I realized that at the time when I felt so lonely, that I felt detached from everyone else, literally, like I was away from the planet, that really I never was alone. That my family and my friends and the people I worked with, the people that I loved and the people that cared about me, they were with me every step of the way. Thank you.